We're talking about a proposed new natural gas plant for Superior. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. This is a proposal that's been in the works for well over 2 years. La Crosse-based Dairyland Power Cooperative and Minnesota Power, they're moving through the permitting phase for plans to build this $700 million natural gas power plant. It's called the Nemadji Trail Energy Center. It would be jointly owned by the two utilities. Minnesota regulators, they signed off on the proposal last fall, and public hearings are set for next month in Wisconsin. So do you live in Superior? What are your thoughts on a new natural gas plant? Is there a need? What should state regulators bear in mind? We're at 800-642-1234. Chris Hubbock covers energy and environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. Chris, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So why did these two utilities want to build this plant together?
That's a good question. They have, both of them have said that this is a needed step for them as they sort of transition away from coal. These are two utilities that are pretty heavily dependent on coal for their generation, about 70-75%. And they see natural gas as sort of a stepping stone to a more renewable-based generation mix as something that can fill in some of the gaps with the intermittent generation.
Would wind and solar be in the mix for this plan?
Well, the Dairyland certainly has added some wind and solar in the past few years. Minnesota Power has some and has some plans to do more. Their argument is that, you know, these are intermittent resources. The wind doesn't always blow, the sun doesn't always shine, and so we need flexible combustion plants that can be called on in a flash to fill in the gaps. The only problem with that argument is not necessarily true at the individual utility level. That's more of a system-wide level, and there are certainly plenty of existing resources on the Midwestern system that can do that.
Why Superior? Why do they want to build the plant in Superior?
That's a great question. For one reason, there's a natural gas supply there. There's a pipeline that can feed the plant. Also, it's a relatively central location. Minnesota Power serves generally northern Minnesota. Dairyland Power's territory, they serve municipal and cooperative utilities sort of in the western part of the state. Their territory extends a little further, but it's kind of a central location for both of them.
Well, this plan has been in the works for some time now, like June 2017. What are the concerns coming out that we're hearing now from environmental groups and you know, the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians?
Yeah, I think there's been concerns all along. Right now, a lot of the focus is on the environmental impact study that the DNR, the Wisconsin DNR, conducted. There's a lot. Some of these environmental groups and as well as the Red Cliff Band are concerned that the study isn't detailed enough. It doesn't address some of the basic questions, such as need. The question of need is sort of not addressed very specifically in there. There's questions about the impact on the direct environment, or were there some wetlands that would be lost in the construction of it. There's questions about whether the aquifer can support 3 million gallons of water a day that the plant would need. And I think the biggest question really is about the climate impact, and that's something that the environmental review doesn't fully address in terms of some of the upstream impacts from natural gas mining, and as well as something that I don't know that the Wisconsin permitting process is really equipped to deal with.
We're talking with Chris Hubbock. He covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. We're talking about a proposed $700 million natural gas plant proposed for Superior, facing some new opposition on both sides of the border of Minnesota and Wisconsin. You can join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Chris, with the timeline and the time it takes to build a natural gas power plant, will the technology still be cost efficient in the next few decades?
You know, that's a great question. And that's one of the arguments that some of the environmental groups like Sierra Club have made, that these utilities are doubling down on fossil fuel at a time when we really, for reasons of climate change, need to be moving in another direction. And when economically things are moving in another direction. Just on Monday, there was a study released by the Rocky Mountain Institute that looked at 88 proposed natural gas plants, including this one, and found that 90% of them, by the time they're finished, would have been, it would be cheaper to provide the same power with a combination of clean energy and energy efficiency measures. So you know, so there, and that ultimately that could save customers like $29 billion nationwide if we didn't build these plants. So there really are some questions. You know, this plant won't be in operation until 2025, and by that point, we're pretty far down the road of a different energy mix.
So, Chris, public hearings are set for October. What's expected to take place at those hearings?
That's where Wisconsin regulators will talk to both the parties involved to do hash out some of the technical details, and then also just a chance for the public to have their voice heard. They can come and you know, speak in support or opposition, voice their concerns, and tell the regulators what they would like them to consider.
And Minnesota's regulators, they approved this last fall. Is that right?
Yeah, it was somewhat controversial. It was a 3-2 vote by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, and it went against the recommendation of the commission's own administrative law judge, who said that she didn't really think that the Minnesota Power had made a good case for the need. There were, you know, there were a lot of questions on that side of the border from not just environmental groups, but also consumer groups and some of the big industrial consumers who really questioned whether there was a need for Minnesota Power to make the investment. That that decision has been appealed by three environmental groups, and there are hearings coming up later this fall in the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So stay tuned on that.
Well, if this project is approved, what is the timeline for construction?
Construction would be complete in 2024. I think it's about a 2-year construction project. And then they plan to begin operation, I think, in December of 2024.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Chris Hubbock covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. Coming up, we go to the depths of the Amazon rainforest. As fires continue to wreak havoc on the region, we learn why this matters to Wisconsin. What questions do you have about the fires in the Amazon? What do you want to know about the environmental impact of fires and deforestation? 800-642-1234 to join in. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about the human-made fires in the Amazon. The world's largest rainforest spans more than 2 million miles in northern South America, mainly in Brazil, And you might have come across this factoid. An area the size of a football field is wiped out every minute. The Amazon rainforest plays a really critical part in regulating our world's oxygen and carbon cycle. And we wanted to know more clearly connect what's happening in the Amazon to our home here in Wisconsin. So what questions do you have about the fires in the Amazon? How should it be managed or regulated? We're at 800-642-1234. Robert Simeone has been a forester in northern Wisconsin and South America for 35 years. His work with indigenous communities in Bolivia, Peru, and Ecuador led him to become one of the founders of the Forest Stewardship Council. Robert, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So Brazil's portion of the Amazon rainforest is burning at the highest rate in years. Is this unusual?
Well, it's a definite uptick from what it's been in the last decade. I mean, to put the Amazon into context, like you say, it's the largest rainforest in the world, and if you could fit the entire continental U.S. within the Amazon basin. So it's a very large area. It also contains about 30% of the world's biodiversity, which is very important. But it's also a massive carbon sink, and it sequesters about 86 billion tons of carbon within the living biomass. The Brazilian Amazon is about 60% of the watershed, and then the rest of the watershed is the upper watershed mainly. It rings the Brazilian plain in the upper watershed, which is consists of about eight countries up in the foothills of the Andes, which is actually the wettest and the most biologically diverse and fragile lands. And these are also suffering large rates of increases in deforestation.
So how much burning is safe and even necessary for the Amazon?
Well, there was, you know, for the good news is that 80% of the forest is still intact. But you also need to understand that we've lost 17% of the Amazon forest in just the last 30 years. So there's been a real, since Brazil established an extensive road network back in the 60s, because they have large population centers in Rio de Janeiro and São Paulo, so they were trying to decentralize the country to some degree. So they were giving land away to people. And today, the Amazon is a home of about 30 million people, of which about 10% are indigenous people. So for the last 30 years or so, we've had massive deforestation occurring, and it reached a peak in 2005, where we lost an area about the size of half of the state of Wisconsin in that time, about 7 million acres. But then that's on the positive side, that was followed by a decade from about 2005 to 2015 of about a 75% decrease in cutting for a variety of policy reasons that the government of Brazil implemented. And they also created large areas of protected areas and indigenous reserves. An area approximately, I use Yellowstone, which is about 2 million acres, as kind of a measure in context. And they established about 25 Yellowstones at that time in the Amazon. So there was it was a very positive thing. But this has now been followed now in the last couple of years with a major increase again in the rate of deforestation. And we're losing an area of about the size of Yellowstone, which is about 2 million acres each year at this point.
We're talking with Robert Simeone. He's a forester who has worked in the forests of Wisconsin and South America for decades. What questions do you have about the fires in the Amazon? 800-642-1234. Robert, the Amazon rainforest gets that nickname, the Earth's lungs, because it produces so much of our planet's oxygen. Why should Wisconsinites be concerned about fires in the Amazon rainforest? Connected home here for us.
Well, I guess the big concern is what the effects it will have on climate change, because it sequesters so much carbon. As the forests burn, this carbon is released into the atmosphere. So about 15% of the global carbon emissions come from world deforestation, right? So the concern is what's referred to as the tipping point in the Amazon, where, as I mentioned, about 17% of the forest has already been cut. If we reach 20 to 25%, and that's very possible to occur within the next 10, 15 years, we could reach this tipping point, which will have widespread effects on climate. Like you say, it's a function of basically oxygen, water, and carbon. Like you say, it's, you know, the Amazon is, you know, called the lungs of the earth because forests take in our take in CO2, carbon, and release oxygen. It's exactly the opposite of what humans do. And so it's very, it's a hell of a service that it provides everyone on the planet, right? But also rainfall, 70% of the rainfall that occurs in the Amazon basin comes from what's referred to as evapotranspiration. And this is trees taking up water through their roots and then evaporating it up back up into the atmosphere through their leaves, right? And this is to the scale of about 20 billion tons of water that are released each day back into the atmosphere just from the Amazon. And that exceeds, you know, the river is the largest in the world, and it dumps about 17 billion tons of fresh water into the sea each year. So the evapotranspiration exceeds what actually goes out into the sea each time. So the problem we see is that if the forest is deforested beyond this tipping point of 20 to 25%, the climate in the Amazon will become warmer and drier. And this will then reduce the remaining forest to natural conversion to savannas. That's non-forest areas, right? And this will result in a massive release of carbon into the atmosphere, and it'll contribute to what's happening in, you know, what we refer to as a cascading event of global climate change. So it just the Amazon alone can have major, major impact on global climate.
Well, let's look at the political influence here. Mark in Menominee has a question. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Good morning. Hey, I'm not quite exactly sure how to answer my question, but my question is, as far as cutting down the forest and not cutting down the forest, and who's responsible for enforcing that? Like, where does that breakdown take place? Is it like, is it a local thing? Is it a government thing? Is it a country thing? Where does that happen?
Yeah, basically all across the Amazon, Brazil and in other countries, it's farmers that are expanding their farmland, right? And you have to think of it as tens of thousands of points of light. This is not like wildfire like we've had in California. The tropical forest will not normally just burn. In fact, it's an asbestos forest. It just won't burn. They have to cut it down and pile it up in windrows and then douse it with kerosene and they burn it, right? So it's the idea of trying to control the fires, like they're trying to do this here by throwing money at it or sending the military up. It's so dispersed. Like I said, tens of thousands of points of farmers, you know, clearing their farmland. So what are the causes of this? It's a lot of it has to do with the newly elected president, Jair Bolsonaro, who has changed a lot of the controls and this incentives that have been established over the years to control deforestation, but also a major impact has been the U.S. Tariffs on China and what that has done, because after the U.S., Brazil is the largest producer of soybeans, so China's scrambling to try to find new sources of soybeans. And this has created a huge demand and higher prices for soybeans in Brazil. And this is pushing deforestation as people are trying to take advantage of by planting larger and larger acreages in soybeans.
Robert, we only have some seconds left, but I understand you were in the Amazon in 2016 last. When you go there, when you visit, can you take us there? What is it like to breathe? What is it like to see? What always just strikes you when you go there?
Well, between the months of August and December, it's pretty impactful or interesting. To, you know, it's discouraging. Let's put it that way. You don't see. on a clear day, you won't see the sun until about 11 o'clock in the morning. Then it's kind of an orange glow, and it starts disappearing about, again, 2 in the afternoon. And it's just the amount of smoke in the air from the burnings. So, you know, just the physical effect of the quality, air quality on millions of people, that's a major thing. But it's very real. People feel this everywhere within the Amazon. You understand, everybody is aware of what's happening. So it's not something that's kind of going on and isolated in an isolated event. No, it's region wide.
Well,
and the impact are region wide.
Yeah, Robert, thank you for bringing us closer. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Robert Simeone has been a forester in northern Wisconsin and South America for 35 years. He's one of the founders of the Forest Stewardship Council. Coming up, areas across the state are considering adding or expanding ATV trails. We'll learn about what that means for communities and tourism. Do you have an ATV? Do you ride? 800-642-1234. We'll be back after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about ATV trails in Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the State Cartographer's Office, Wisconsin has more than 1,800 miles of all-terrain vehicle trails and intensive use areas available during the spring, summer, and fall months. And in the winter, the trail access balloons to more than 4,200 miles open to riders. ATVs and utility task vehicles now share many of Wisconsin's roadways. Is your community looking at adding ATV routes? What do you think about the possible change? Do you support the route? Do you live near an ATV trail? What has that experience been like? We're at 800-642-1234. Heather Gutchalk is the recreation warden with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and she covers seven counties in central and northeastern Wisconsin. Heather, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, give us a snapshot of ATV trails in Wisconsin. How many trails do we have here? How do they cover our state?
The majority of our trails are, of course, northern and western Wisconsin, with there being some like railroad grade, old railroad tracks converted into trails down the southwest part of the state. The eastern, southeast, central, and a portion of the northeast part of the state is kind of lacking in the trails. And in those areas, you've seen an increase in ATV, UTV routes.
So how are ATV trails regulated in Wisconsin?
State Statute 2333 is the statute that regulates the operation of ATVs, whether you're on a route or a trail. A lot of the trails in northern Wisconsin go through some of the federal land and some of the state land, and then they're privately maintained by clubs and organizations that are ATV orientated.
Can you explain the difference between a route and a trail?
A trail is strictly off-road. It's someplace you would not expect to necessarily operate a regular motor vehicle. They're narrow and they're just that. They're a trail. They're completely off-road. A route is on the improved portion of a roadway where you would expect to operate or see somebody operating a truck or a car that could be paved. It could be, if you're up north, a section of gravel road that's seasonally or that's maintained throughout the year. So routes are on roads or in some cases sidewalks. Trails are off the beaten path and they're just that, they're a trail.
Well, Heather, on the beaten path, though, these routes, they can't be interstates, I understand, but you could even go on some county highways?
That is correct. Based on ordinances that are created by municipalities and in some cases counties, they can open up some highways to ATV traffic. There is a state statute passed, an act passed a couple years ago that opened up highways posted 35 miles an hour or less to ATV UTV traffic. I guess one thing I just want to mention is there's no such thing as a UTV route.
Okay.
ATV routes are open to UTVs unless posted otherwise. So as we have our conversation, if I just say ATV route, that includes UTVs as well.
We're talking ATV trails in Wisconsin with Heather Gutchock. She is the recreation warden with the DNR. Do you ride ATV in Wisconsin? Where do you go and how often do you ride? What are your favorite trails? Where do you find that it is inaccessible to ride? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Jay now, joining us from Birchwood. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Kate. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind about ATVs?
Well, my wife and I recently bought a home in the country, northern Wisconsin, on a paved road, and come to find out it is an ATV or UTV route, whatever. They both ride up and down, and the last thing we would like to see is expansion because it is a major problem with noise. The trails are all torn up and eroded. It's like to ride bike. And you can't ride bike on them. So, you know, we're considering moving, but as we travel throughout the state, we see that they're becoming more and more everywhere. So,
Jay,
check me off for somebody who's not in favor of expansion.
Jay, thanks so much for the call and those thoughts. Jay, very concerned about the wear and tear on these trails. And then there's the noise, Heather.
Yep, Jay is not alone in his concerns. We have seen influx in the development of ATV routes, and that is one of the concerns is the noise. Not everybody is an ATV or UTV owner or operator, and they can be loud. There are restrictions, laws that restrict the noise level on them. But some people modify them, and they're not a silent machine. I mean, they do make a certain amount of noise as they travel down the road. As far as the trails being tore up, they do cause some damage. They have big tires on them, and that's why the clubs spend money to maintain the trail. A lot of the routes, or the majority of the routes, they do not allow the operation of the machines off the paved portion because of the damage that could occur to the shoulder. And the municipalities don't want to expend that kind of money to continually fix those shoulders, so they're restricted to operating on the paved portion. But he's not alone in his concern.
So why have Wisconsin counties added more ATV options across the state in the past few years?
The number of ATVs and UTVs being purchased and registered with our agency has surpassed snowmobile registration. The use of them is obviously on the increase, and people want to use them. They want to use them. They've gotten the machines themselves have changed, especially UTVs. They want to use them to travel to their hunting land, to travel downtown, to go get groceries, or you know, whatever you do downtown. So their use has changed. The number of them being purchased and used has increased, and with that, people want to use them. So they're pushing their municipalities, their townships, to make these routes so they have a place to use them, so they don't have to travel up north or over to Clark County or someplace like that just to use the machine that they just spent a great deal of money on.
Well, let's bring in Debbie now. Debbie in Genesee. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So we have a Razor 1000. It's a desert edition, and we are Wisconsin residents, but we go out to Arizona during the winter and bought it from a place here in Wisconsin. But the wheelbase is it's 64 inches wide, and we've often been told that we can't use it on the trails. Do you know what the, here in Wisconsin, do you know what the actual width is of these UTVs, the maximum restriction?
Well, it differs. I gotta find the definition of the ATV. Anytime you have a machine that is modified outside of the definition of ATV or UTV, then it no longer is considered an ATV or UTV by Wisconsin statute.
And I know, I believe the Federal Forest routes, I believe those are 55, but I will have to.
Do you see, Heather, a lot of variation on how these ATVs are built and their wheelbase and things like that?
Not so much in the ATVs.
Okay.
We're seeing a change in the UTVs. They are just like her UTV. Hers is probably modified for the desert use, but we're seeing manufacturers making them wider than the legal size.
Well, let's bring in Peter now in Baraboo with thoughts on this. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I serve as the chair of the Sauk County Board of Supervisors, and our highway committee has done extensive work on the ordinances that control the use of ATVs, UTVs, trying to find the middle ground between those who enjoy the utilization of these vehicles and, of course, those who are on the routes. We have asked the clubs to take more responsibility in filling out specific forms that along the route show that the residents are in favor. These are time sensitive, and so if a resident determines that it's no longer applicable, that can be brought to the highway committee. We are, like most others, I think, caught in the middle ground between trying to find a solution that supports the growth and utilization of these vehicles from an economic development standpoint, at the same time protecting the environment and the safety of both those who use the equipment as well as those who are subjected to its use. So I believe that it is going to be very important that we elevate this from a municipality, town, city to a more universal look from a state standpoint, of finding ways in which routes can be connected that do not include major county roads or highways, many of which become restricted. So I've been asking that there be a statewide commission to take a look at not just the utilization and what is happening in terms of its growth, but helping to plan as they do various
kinds
of transportations. Yep.
Peter, thank you. Yeah,
it's a critical factor.
Thanks so much for bringing your thoughts from the Sauk County Board of Supervisors and the approach that Sauk County is taking as we look at ATV trails, these routes, with Heather Gottschalk. She's the recreation warden with the DNR covering seven counties. Do you work for a township or a village that doesn't have an ATV route? What's your take on these? Should Wisconsin add more routes? Should it take up a commission here? 800-642-1234 to join in. We'll get back to this in just a minute. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Wisconsin's approach to creating ATV trails and routes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and there are groups that want to keep out ATVs, as we've been hearing. Ann Brower is with the Alliance to Preserve Boulder Junction, and she told WPR the region's connection to the wilderness is its main economic asset, and that's something too many loud ATV motors could put in jeopardy.
For more than 100 years, people have come for this very reason. Can we protect it for the future?
Do you live in an area that is trying to keep out ATV routes? Explain your position. What's your take on them? 800-642-1234. Heather Gottschalk stays with us. She is the recreation warden with the DNR covering seven counties. Let's go back to the phones now. Greg is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Greg.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I just had a quick. I had a quick question. I have a cabin up in Ainsworth County that is right on the border. Actually, my land borders an ATV route. What I'm wondering is if there are any laws or regulations that limit the amount of time that these machines can be on the trails. We've had ATVs come out of the woods midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning, and not only is it a noise factor, but in my opinion, it's also a safety factor. And like lakes have wake rules that you can't make a wake or have noise after 4 or 5 p.m. depending on the lake. I'm wondering if there's something that applies to the ATVs.
Thanks, Greg.
In general, no. If there was a restriction on hours, that is generally created in an ordinance by the local municipality. I have not seen it on a trail. They could only create an ordinance that they have, only create an ordinance for a trail that they have control over that trail within their jurisdiction. We do see some ordinances for routes that have time restrictions from, let's say, 10 p.m. to 7 a.m., for example. Like I said, I haven't seen it for trails, but I'm not in an area that has a lot of trails. I have mostly routes, but and I have seen it routes. So it would be something the local municipality would have to create an ordinance for.
Let's bring in Judy now in Verona. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I am against allowing ATVs and UTVs on bicycle trails. I've been on trails that have allowed both. And once an ATV is on those gravel bike trails, they're not usable anymore for cyclists. They're too rutted. And that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. You know, what is the compatibility there, Heather, as people use these trails for other things, whether it is biking or hiking?
For your majority of your the railroad grades that have been converted for bike trails, it's unusual. They do exist, but it's unusual to that they would allow ATVs on them because there's so much time and money spent creating that platform for the bikes. I used to work for the parks, and one of the areas that I worked was on a bike trail. And there's a lot of work that goes into it. So they generally don't allow ATVs on there, but there are some that don't have quite the same base on them, and they haven't spent as much time on them. They were created more as a dual-use trail. So they do allow ATVs on them, and yes, they do. Over time, they will create loose gravel and ruts. By the nature of the tires, that is going to happen. And it does, for a road bike, it makes it very dangerous. For a mountain bikes can tolerate a little bit more, but it can still make it an uncomfortable ride if you're looking for something smooth. As far as compatibility, for the most part, you try and, I think they try and keep the ATVs on their own trails. If you want to go hike on an ATV trail, it's kind of the responsibility of both the hiker and the ATVer to operate safely and such that you can avoid hitting anything legally on the trail. And it's up to the hiker to, you know, be attentive to their surroundings. And if they hear an ATV, maybe step off the trail.
We're talking with Recreation Warden Heather Gottschalk from the DNR. We're looking at these ATV trails and routes. And earlier, Heather, we heard from the Sauk County supervisor who said, look, we're trying to find a middle ground here. What would you tell communities as they grapple with finding that delicate balance and they look to add ordinances?
Communication. They need to have those meetings. And the public needs to attend them. It's not oftentimes what we'll see is we'll just see the people that really want it that'll be there. Or if it's such that it's, you know, the whole community doesn't want it, then the people that don't want it show up. But it's rare that we actually see a good showing on both sides. I've attended quite a few town board meetings to answer questions, and you got to show up. If the meeting's there, you've got to show up, and you got to get your friends to show up too. And then we need to communicate and see what each other's concerns are. I commend the Sauk board for doing what they're doing because that's the way to make it work. And as well as looking countywide, go from county to county instead of township to township. That is a concern of a lot of law enforcement agencies. It's very difficult to know what all the laws are within each little township, to to have all those ordinances memorized. And the county patrols have made it known that they would be interested in moving from townships to county to county to county, and or a statewide organization to make all the routes the same,
more seamless.
Yeah.
Let's bring in Mike now in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi, and first off, thanks to the officer for coming on and talking. Thanks for your service. It's a thankless job, I'll tell you. The concern that I have, I call him from Milwaukee, but I recreate and family has a place in a small town in Russ County, and we have UTV route or ATV route right next door in the city. And we have ATV routes elsewhere in the county that we're associated with. And it's the usual suspects, the same people that are speeding and have mufflers cut off or no mufflers bored out or what have you on ATVs are the same ones that have it on their motorcycles. They're the same ones that have it on their trucks. They're the same ones that have it on their cars. They have it on their snowmobiles. The problem is enforcement. Not about whether the ATV is there or not. It's, are we enforcing the rules and regulations around the use of those ATVs and whether they have proper noise restrictions and so forth? That's if you really want to expand the use of ATV. For those people who want to expand the use of the ATVs, you're going to have to, work with law enforcement like yourself and figure out how we can enforce the use laws.
And Heather, I want to jump in there, Mike, because we're short on time. Heather, do you see that enforcement is an issue?
It is. All agencies seem to be short-staffed. They have a lot on their platter. And quite frankly, when it comes to ATVs, unless it's something that happens in front of them, why they're going from point A to point B, it's difficult for them to focus an actual patrol on those. Now, we do reimburse the counties for recreation patrol. So we try and get that out there. We have special enforcement details when we know there's going to be a heavy use weekend. We try and get as many officers over there or wherever that's at as we can. But it's definitely, there's can't be every place all the time, and inevitably if the loud mufflers on the east side of the county, you're on the west side of the county, and by the time you get over there, they're gone. So self-enforcement with other riders also helps. The caller is spot on with his concerns. It's always one bad egg that makes the rest look bad. And I just want to answer that lady's question about the width. The UTV has to be no wider than 65, and an ATV is no wider than 50.
Well, Heather,
still listening.
Yeah, Heather, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Heather Gutchalk is recreation warden with the Wisconsin DNR. She covers Green Lake, Marquette, Outagamie, Wapaka, Washera, Winnebago, and Calumet counties. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.